Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It is Saturday, October 27th, 2012. I'm Harley Schlanger and I will be your host. With just over a week to go until the presidential election, Lyndon LaRouche has made a powerful intervention on behalf of the future of our republic. For the last four Friday nights, he's done a webcast, which he has called the Friday Project, with one more to come this coming Friday. And these are available to our listeners on LaRouchePAC.com. And in these Friday Project webcasts, he's put forward what is not going on with the campaign, but what you as citizens must know if we're going to save our republic. He's also written several new papers that are also available at LaRouchePAC, one called The Coming of the End of the Cult of Sense Deception. And then this week he wrote one called The End for Dummies, Man's Crucial Future Role in Space. And what he's done with these, along with the Friday Project, is address the real higher issue of the campaign, which has been hidden by the two candidates, that of the danger of a nuclear World War III coming from the British Empire and initiated by their puppet, Barack Obama. And as he's done since April 2009, he's continued to insist that Obama must go. But he's also raising a deeper, more profound question, which is why is it that the U.S. population accepts being talked down to by the candidates, by their surrogates, and by the media? How did we come to this point of having to choose between a murderous fascist, Obama, and someone who proudly describes himself as a businessman, Romney, but who has yet to offer any serious solutions to the disintegration of the economy while ignoring Obama's drive to thermonuclear war? This is going to be our topic today on the LaRouche Show. And joining me will be two, I guess I can call them, senior collaborators of Lyndon LaRouche, Phil Rubenstein and Bruce Director, both of whom have devoted their lives to these deeper scientific and philosophical issues that are raised by Mr. LaRouche, which will provide answers to the question of what has happened to us as a human civilization and how do we disseminate the method of creative thinking, or I should even say before we disseminate, how can we practice the method of creative thinking which we can then disseminate, because that's the only way that we can escape the present existential crisis. And more importantly than just escaping the crisis, lift mankind off the earth into a new era of life in our solar system and beyond. So, Phil and Bruce, welcome to the program.
Well, good to be on.
Good to be here.
Let's begin with the so-called presidential campaign and get it out of the way quickly, which I think most Americans right now would like to do. Bruce, you heard a discussion that Mr. LaRouche had with his associates this morning. What's the central point that he's making about these two candidates?
Well, the central point is that you don't really have a candidate yet. You have one candidate, Obama, who has to go. And he said you got another guy who's waiting in line. Now, what he's waiting in line for, he didn't specify, but I think the ambiguity is probably the best way to leave it. He emphasized that if you looked at the debate, the last debate there in Florida, he said it was the most ridiculous thing. It was two guys arguing about who was the bigger idiot, because they didn't say anything that offered anybody anything. And that we're in, the reality is, as he went through again and again, especially in his webcast last night, that we're in hyperinflation and we're facing the threat of thermonuclear war. And the instability that the British Empire have created globally is putting us in a situation where you're either going to die by hyperinflation collapse or you're going to die by nuclear war, and the only thing that will work is the three-point program that he, LaRouche, has laid out, which is a return to Glass-Steagall, a development of a credit system, and then these large-scale development projects.
Bruce, I might add, as far as the last debate was concerned, there was only one moment of a glimmer of reality, which is when the moderator, Bob Schieffer, opened it by referring to the fact that 50 years ago, the Cuban Missile Crisis was underway and John F. Kennedy had to make a decision that was one that put us close to nuclear war. Now, I would say after that, Schieffer fell into the muck with the two of them, and there were no higher moments. But outside of that, I don't think there's been a single reference to this nuclear war danger other than what Lynn has done.
No, and in fact, both Romney and Obama were sort of competing as to who would have the stupidest policy to lead us directly into thermonuclear war. But Lynn emphasized again that, you know, there's no compromise. Obama's got to go. He's got to finish it, get out of there. But and that, you know, he said also if Obama is defeated, there's also a danger that he'll go berserk during the lame duck session before he leaves. And if he stays in there, if he is reelected, he'll be triumphant, but he might be a little cautious, at least for a short period of time. But he said the point is neither point matters because you got to get Obama out of there, and the problem is Romney is not a presidential candidate yet.
Well, Bruce, and just again on that point, I think that one of the points Lynn has made to go to this first question, if Obama loses, the one thing that will change if he loses is the Democrats will no longer be forced to support him for the basis of party unity. And I guess, Phil, I'd like to ask you, that goes at the other question that Lynn has been talking about, which is the insanity of the current party system. I wonder if you'd say a couple things about that.
Well, I think what Lynn has made the point that, you know, the people treat this like team sports. And, of course, the country itself has become a bunch of spectator fanatics, you know, stripping down nude in 2-degree weather to put on the colors of their football team. And you know, one of the worst places in the country is the Washington Redskins, with the most fanatic, lunatic fans, including among the Congress and so forth. But that's the way they look at it. So, you know, you have to be loyal to the party. And you go along to get along with the party and you to get your man in, no, really, no matter what he believes. The idea of a president of the nation is completely lost. If there is an office that has to represent a national mission, it's the presidency. The presidency, in many ways, the whole debate over the Constitution, the Federalist Papers was a debate over whether it was the Union came first, and therefore the executive was the only one who represented the nation as a whole. That has been totally lost in the population, so that they'll vote for Obama because he's the Democratic Party candidate, even though the typical African American, for example, has admitted Obama has screwed them. He's done them not only no good, he's done worse than no good. Or then take your typical household, with senior citizens, et cetera, et cetera. They think that they need Obama to protect them and maintain their loyalty to the Democratic Party. The Republicans are businessmen. This whole businessman model has nothing to do with the history of the United States. The idea that a small business can exist without infrastructure, electrical grids, water management, of course there's individual initiative, but within that context. And so we're incapable of electing a president who represents any form of intellect to grasp the role of the United States, its mission in the world. So you get Bush twice, and the whole country split down the middle. It's been that way, over the last 12 years. And this is what brought Obama in, was simply we want somebody who will be loyal to the Democratic Party. I think a good example, not to be too long-winded, but besides George Washington and Ben Franklin, who warned against party and faction and sectionalism. I mean, there were many moves to secession even before the Southern secession. But John Quincy Adams, who was Secretary of State, ambassador to Russia, ambassador to Great Britain, in many ways the greatest president and the least respected president we've ever had. He was barely ever even the member of a party. He always stood for a national mission and a national interest. Infrastructure, science, scientific development, research and development, astronomical observatories. And then, of course, in the last decade and a half of his life, he was the one person who stood in the Congress every day against the slaveocracy. And he was vilified by Northern Whigs who compromised with the South, and Southern Whigs, who compromised with the slaveocracy, and Northern Democrats who compromised with the slaveocracy. And it came directly from the Andrew Jackson presidency run by Martin Van Buren. And the pride of these guys is they set up the party system, beginning with Van Buren, Burr in the background, and Jackson. This is the origin of the Democratic Party. Section, faction, and no concept of a national interest, which is a national mission,
This is where Lynn has been emphasizing this question of principle over party. Mm-hmm. And I want to get to that in a moment, because the topic of our program today is really, what is the scientific basis of statecraft in terms of the development of culture? But one thing that I just want to reference is this question of Romney as the businessman. It's very reminiscent to me of Sinclair Lewis's novel Main Street and the character of Babbitt, who is the perfect example of pragmatism, popular opinion, always having the right opinion to be acceptable in the Kiwanis Club or the Rotary Club, and who is completely ignorant of the world outside of his shop. And I think that's part of the point that Lynn's getting at on this question of Romney as a businessman, as opposed to having a candidate who actually stands for principle.
Yeah, exactly. And the issue of principle over party is interesting that Phil brought up John Quincy Adams, because among his many characteristics was that he was a scientist. And he drew his ability to stand for principle over party because he was an intellectual. He was probably the smartest president we had. And he spent his whole life trying to master the most advanced things in science and art that were available, and to promote them as president of the United States. And he was actually ridiculed by the Jacksonians because he advocated that the United States begin developing astronomical observatories. He said Europe had hundreds and the United States had none, and this is unacceptable. When he was ambassador to Berlin, he hired a tutor to teach him German so he could read Schiller and the German classics in the original German.
Well, this gets to this question that Lynn has been raising now, not just in these last three papers, but literally for 45 years, which is the intersection of classical culture and classical science, and that the common basis for that is the creative mind and the creative mind's relationship to the universe. And I guess this is where we should start in the discussion, given that the population right now is so beneath even the minimal requirements for being able to choose candidates. That's why we ended up with such a menagerie in the Republican Party, out of which Romney emerged, and no one had the guts in the Democratic Party to challenge Obama. So, Phil, I think this would be a good place to start this question of where we got off, this reductionism. Lynn often refers to the period at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. How does that fit into this question of the idiocy of the population today?
Well, I think the critical point, though, there's many aspects to it, is that if you go to the end of the 19th century, in particular, you have two people, Max Planck and Albert Einstein, who were looking and developing either consciously or unconsciously from the standpoint of Bernard Riemann, in one sense, it's like Kepler. The physics of the reality of the universe is what's dominant. And the reality of the universe is knowable to the human mind, but not to sense perception. And so they were led, they used mathematics as a tool, but they were led to go beyond any deductive mathematics to reorganize our conception of the microscopic and the macroscopic. You know, Planck, of course, is famous for the discovery of the quanta, the idea that changes in the small occur by certain kinds of discrete leaps of a certain kind. And Einstein himself extended this to light and the photon. And, of course, also, really, Einstein makes very clear the idea of universal principle, because relativity theory is not relative. What's ironic about it is that it destroys the idea of an absolute space and time that's has a special status from which to observe or from which to measure, to the idea that we look for a universal invariant, a universal principle, such that every observer has equivalent status. There is no preferred observational standpoint, but we're looking for universal principles that govern every potential coordinate system. This then gets extended to include non-constant coordinate systems in the form of general relativity theory and so forth. So Einstein is working on both of these and rejecting completely that these are defined by sense perception. Now, this gives us an insight both into the astronomical, the astrophysical, because really until the beginning of the 20th century, we didn't even know there were galaxies. And the whole idea of the cosmos completely undergoes a change at the same time that we now are dealing with the phenomena of radiation and the atomic, subatomic, nuclear, and so forth. So that this idea of knowledge as coming from the creative mind, and there are many, many quotes from Einstein and Planck to that effect, that there's no deductive approach that works. Now, this was assaulted, and really it was assaulted in the form of the attack on Riemann by people like Weierstrass and some confused people like Hilbert.
Well, Phil, also, I'd like to bring Bruce in on this because, you know, as you're talking about this question, the real assault was well underway in the 19th century with the second law of thermodynamics and the attack on the idea of a dynamic universe. Wasn't that the case, Bruce?
Well, yeah, that came in actually at a time in which man was making tremendous breakthroughs in economy and technology as a result of a mastery of physical principles that Phil was just referencing. The Einstein-Planck work comes really as the culmination, and it shouldn't have been a culmination. It should have been a new beginning. Another step forward, but because of what happened subsequently, which we'll talk about in a minute, it really was a culmination of a process which goes all the way back to Cusa in the Renaissance, in which man and scientific investigations were making progress by recognizing that the universe as a whole functioned the way the human mind does, always organizing itself to higher states of organization and existence. And the way that expresses itself in the human mind is through creative discoveries of new principles of the universe, but also new principles of the mind, which we associate with great artistic work. And so you see this with Kuza, with Kepler, with Leibniz, and as a result, every new advance in human intellectual discovery spawned a huge increase in man's power in and over the universe as expressed by developments in technology. And by the beginning of the 19th century, or the early part, this culminated with the development of the heat-powered machine.
Bruce, wasn't all of this really explicit with Leibniz? Because he sort of unified these ideas of scientific advance and philosophy with the establishment of real physical economy.
And with politics. And it was Leibniz's universal thinking which actually gave great impetus to the development of the United States. And Leibniz pulled all this together, and you had this great development in technology, and this put man in a position where we were harnessing physical processes which we didn't quite understand. Heat is something that people are quite, you know, man had been using for all his existence to control a fire, but not as a power source. And by harnessing it as a power source, man was stepping into a whole new domain. And the difficulty was to how to, and this occurred also at the same time that man was harnessing electricity as a source and magnetism as well. So you had heat, electricity, magnetism. Our understanding of gravity became greater as a result of Kepler and Gauss later, and also light, new discoveries of what was the nature of light were all happening in this period. So you have these powers, light, gravity, magnetism, electricity, heat, which are non-material, insubstantial things which have nevertheless a power to be able to produce a physical effect. And the point that Planck made is that these physical effects interact with us through our senses, like light interacts with our retinas and heat interacts with our sense of touch and so forth. But these things actually exist beyond the domain of sense perception, that there's things that appear to be separate, like heat and light, because heat is associated with touch and light is associated with vision, are actually not separate. It's just that our senses are separate. So our senses deceive us by saying that these are two separate things. But they're obviously related because an object that's heated up produces light, and if you shine light on an object, you can generate heat. So there was a striving for a universal conception of what it is about the organization of the universe that is consistent with the way the human mind works.
Hey, let me just take a quick break right here to let you know that you're listening to The LaRouche Show. It is October 27th, 2012, and we're talking with Bruce Director and Phil Rubenstein about a series of new papers by Lyndon LaRouche on principles of science, the human mind, economics, and politics. Now, we started by talking about the breakdown of what you just described, Bruce, as this universal striving for increasing the control of man over higher orders of power. And I think this is what, when I interrupted Phil a couple minutes ago, this is what he was about to pick up by talking about what was done toward the end of the 19th century, which launched the attacks on Einstein and Planck. So let me bring Phil in on this now.
Yeah, well, you know, the situation, remember, this is the period, the last third of the 19th century, where there's a certain tendency of the American system after the Civil War and what Lincoln did, and the exposition of 1876, for an American system of continuous scientific industrial development and the introduction of certain cultural features into the development of the citizenry in terms of education and so forth. This was occurring in Germany under Bismarck. There were alliances with some of the Russians, Alexander II, who freed the serfs. There were other phenomena like that in China, and so forth. Now, the empire, the British Empire, but the empire, carried out an explicit epistemological war, or a psychological war, against the population to sustain the oligarchic principle. And in an oligarchic principle, there is no change. There is no progress. There's simply the rule of an oligarchy, which stands above even an emperor or anything of that sort. So you had a wave of attacks on classical music, which began earlier, but was culminating in the mid to late 19th century with the rise of people like Liszt and Wagner and so on and so forth. And you had similar things in all of the art forms. At the same time, you had this reductionism in science, the idea that everything, and I think it's, there's an interesting point that's kind of hard to get. There was a standard that was demanded, which said that anything that is knowably true must be 100% true, certain. You must have absolute certainty. And the only thing you can have absolute certainty about is sense experience and logical deduction or mathematical deduction, induction, deduction. You have sense experiences, you generalize them, they become an axiom, and
who
you
is,
deduce
who
things.
Who is pushing this, Phil? Where did this come from? This came
largely from an expansion of British empiricism, and it comes, the biggest figure in this, in the creation of this deductive approach, was Bertrand Russell. Russell attacked Riemann, Russell attacked Leibniz in his History of Philosophy, and then, of course, he writes Principia Mathematica, which is to reduce all arithmetic and fundamentally all human knowledge to a fixed, complete system. You know, the idea of a perfect system is a system that it really has no purpose to it. It's ended, it's finished, it's complete.
And so Russell was an explicit operative of this British monarchy, this British financial elite.
Absolutely. He was from, you know, he was from the oligarchic Russell family of Lord Russell, who, of course, was a supporter of the Confederacy in the mid-19th century. And he carried out a psychological warfare against anybody who rejected this and recruited, you know, some... you know, scientists who had some capability to this outlook, particularly around the anomalies that were occurring that would lead you to new discoveries. Some of the paradoxes of quantum theory, wave particle duality and light. If you were Kepler, you would look at these things and you would create a vicarious hypothesis, a hypothesis that demonstrated the contradiction and pointed to a solution, to the other side of the vicarious hypothesis that Lynn talks about, which is the metaphor or the hypothesis that generates a new power that otherwise didn't exist. And Russell's whole view was you couldn't do that. That was all mysticism. This was picked up by the logical positivists, and it was ultimately used against Einstein and Planck in the Solvay conferences, particularly at the end of the 1920s, 1927, 1930.
I was just going to ask you that this is exactly that Planck and Einstein were going towards what you were describing as an approach in science, and that's what Russell attacked.
Exactly. Both of them thought that there was some unified conception, not a field theory, which was a mathematical equation, but some unified conception about the nature of reality, and they both pointed to it most explicitly in their conception of what scientific discovery demanded, that this was the nature of real human creativity. In fact, Megan Riard sent me I think other people have seen this, but give you an idea of a quote from Planck in 1944, and I think this is after he's changed some of his views more along the lines of Wolfgang Kohler. He says, "As a man who has devoted his whole life to the most clear-headed science, to the study of matter, I can tell you as a result of my research about atoms this much. There is no matter as such. All matter originates and exists only by virtue of a force which brings the particle of an atom to vibration and holds this most minute solar system of the atom together. We must assume behind this force the existence of conscious and intelligent mind. This mind is the matrix of all matter." So I think that's a stunning comment in 44. It's late in his life. He passed away 4 years later. But this is what the power of the human mind, the liberation of people from slavery, from what is effectively, as Lynn describes it, a distinction of species in society. Some species are slaves. Some species get to work at wage slavery. Some species rule the others. And humanity is not a group of separate species. It's characterized by a single species quality, which is what Lynn calls creativity per se. It's the ability to generate qualitative changes in mankind's power over the universe, which does for human beings what biological change does for animals.
Now, Bruce, you've written quite a bit about this. You did a whole lengthy series on Riemann. Just give us your thoughts on what Phil just said.
Well, I think the quote from Planck is quite useful to reflect on, because this is exactly, you know, the standpoint of Leibniz and also the standpoint of Kuza. But it's not the standpoint of modern science. And this really sort of got really revved up at the end of the 19th century around the second law of thermodynamics, but they were able to get away with it because they dealt with something more fundamental, which was to what Phil was talking about, that if you limit acceptable human thought to sense perception and deductive logic, then you say that there are two worlds. There's the world of mind, and then there's the world of the objective world. And the world of mind, all kinds of strange things can happen in it, but the world of the objective world outside the mind works only according to sense perception and logical deduction. And once you get somebody to accept that, it's like going back to Ptolemy. You can get them to accept that the whole universe basically tends in a direction which always goes towards equilibrium, and that the most perfect state in the physical world is a state where there isn't any change, and everything man does, which puts the world in disequilibrium, is screwing up this natural tendency to go to equilibrium. And from there you get the foolishness of the green policy and everything else. And really what we have to do right now, and what LaRouche has sort of sparked, I think, not just with the work recently around the basement, but really going all the way back to the founding of the Fusion Energy Foundation, where he was really being a provocation and an impetus, and in some cases even a pain in the ass to the scientific community, to get the shackles of sense perception and deductive logic and mathematics out of their heads and start to really investigate the way in which the universe itself actually is self-organizing to higher states of organization and existence, higher states like you see in plasmas and in stars and galaxies, but also in living processes as well.
Bruce, and just in terms of the stars and galaxies, there have been some new discoveries recently about the self-organizing processes of galaxies throughout the universe.
Well, and that's exactly the point, that man has made progress despite the way most people think, because the mind doesn't obey mathematics and doesn't obey the second law of thermodynamics, but operates according to creative insight. And a properly inspired and motivated creative individual will make discoveries that constantly contradict the false assumptions that everybody repeats as if they're some type of religious dogma. And we've gotten to a point where we've made so many discoveries about the physical world that contradict the prevailing religious dogma, as I call it, which is known as scientific theory, that, you know, we can do one of two things. We can keep categorizing all these things that violate what most people believe, or we could change what we believe. And, you know, I prefer the latter, but the problem is it's sort of like trying to get Democrats to vote against Obama. They hate him. They know he's no damn good. They know he's the worst president we've ever had in history, but they're sort of constrained to the party system as if it's some religious belief. And we're right now ripe in politics as well as in science and art for a revolution like we were at the time of the Renaissance, where people say, maybe it's all these stupid-ass things we've been believing all these years which has got us into this mess and not some external force, so maybe we ought to change the way we think. And what happened in the Renaissance is there was a leadership, Kuza, Brunelleschi, Leonardo da Vinci, Machiavelli, great thinkers who you know, put forward a solution, a change, a new way to think. And today we have LaRouche, and that's really the direction mankind has to go.
Well, and the other part of that is that the Renaissance grew out of a near-death experience in Europe with the collapse of the banking system in the middle of the 14th century and the bubonic plague and the destruction of cities and parishes and regions. Whole regions of Europe went through depopulation.
Exactly.
Today we face the reality of a danger of thermonuclear war, which most Americans are not even aware of. In fact, they think if you tell them this is a probability, they think you're so 1980s or 70s or even 60s. They've lost that sense. And I want to come back to that point toward the end of the program. But, Phil, I'd like to come back to you then on this question of the development of the pragmatism, the reductionism, coming out of the Solvay conferences. We have seen some scientific breakthroughs. We've seen it with the space program. We've seen it with nuclear research. But on the whole, we're still operating with the paradigm that Bruce just described, which is
right.
Living off old discoveries and destroying the method of discovery, no?
Absolutely. I mean, look, one good example, look at it from two standpoints. First of all, how much we clearly don't know about the development of the solar system even. For example, just recently the Cassini satellite picked up off of a storm on Saturn an incredible leap in temperature. Don't forget, this is a planet way, you know, out beyond Jupiter. And they found, in the middle of the storm, a 150-degree Fahrenheit leap in temperature. As one person said, equivalent from going to Fairbanks, winter in Fairbanks to summer in the Mojave Desert in an instant, virtually. So there are things in our own solar system which we have no idea. We really don't know what the orbits of many of the asteroids are, which represent a threat, LaRouche has pointed out, to the planet. We have to have two things that we could do. First of all, have a much different sense of the harmonics of the asteroid belt itself, and secondly, sufficient energy flux density to create forces that would throw these things into different orbits or block them off in some way or other. This requires deeper understanding of both astronomical phenomena, the solar system, which is the nearest space we can deal with, and also nuclear phenomena. Now, the paradigm that exists for both the universe and the nuclear is one simple model. It's a gas statistical model. The idea is everything started with a big bang, and then you had what Bruce describes as this movement toward equilibrium based on statistical averages of collisions amongst isotopes, plasmas, you know, stripped down nuclei, and then when this would stop and so on and so forth. Now that becomes also the entire model for the structure of the nucleus, because supposedly the nucleus came out of this process. That's why we're stuck. We've got a gas statistical empiricist model and a mathematical schema, the so-called standard model and so forth. So we're just, you know, we try to recreate the Big Bang in an accelerator. These things may be useful if we knew what the hell we were doing. But we haven't looked at this from the standpoint that Planck and Einstein and Riemann and Lin in particular looks at it, because you've got to look at it from the standpoint of noetic processes from the top down. You have to look at it from the standpoint of anti-entropic processes and how that would actually function in the creation of singularities, which we call particles, but are really part of a conception of an ongoing development of a singular universe. So we're not looking at the relationship of biology, life, as Lynn puts it in not this paper, but one of the earlier papers, and noetic life. These are the universe.
And
the universe created these. Yes, sorry.
I was just going to say, and what you're describing is enforced with a real fascist, inquisitional approach in, or policy in science to the scientific establishment. You see this in terms of the attack, the real vitriol, where Planck and Einstein were attacked, starting, you know, really back, even as far back as, you know, 1912, 1914, mm-hmm. but certainly after World War I, in which these two giants, intellectual giants, who were always striving to discover new ideas and make revolutions, were ridiculed and criticized and attacked to try and intimidate every scientist coming up into accepting this gas dynamical theory of the universe. And to this day, that kind of inquisition exists. If you're a scientist who makes an important discovery, and you try and assert that the discovery contradicts this standard gas dynamical model, that's the end of your career.
Well, Bruce, and isn't this also the whole issue of the takedown of NASA by the Obama administration? Because as Lynn has been discussing this going back years, that you can very clearly start looking at some of these anomalies through space exploration and also through putting new satellites in space, orbiters in space, but that's being destroyed now. It's all being taken down except for that which is directly related to the military.
Yeah, well, what this gets at really is this question of the cultural level, the population. You know, Planck and Einstein were I don't want to say cultural icons, but they were highly regarded intellectual leaders way beyond the limited scientific community. You know, Planck was such a revered figure in Germany that even Hitler had to be careful as to what he said. So the population, and the same thing with Einstein, and so the population, the general cultural level of the population was high enough to the point where even though there was a real brutal effort to try and impose this false ideas around quantum mechanics and so forth on people, there was a cultural resistance to it. So if you take down NASA and you break the connection, the popular connection among the general population, the scientific discovery, as we've done since the, you know, takedown of NASA and what's happened since the middle of the 1960s, sort of cement the ability to run a tyranny over the scientific community. And of course, right now it's really bad because people have access to the internet, which can be quite dangerous. As one of my friends once told me, that stupidity travels very fast on the information superhighway.
Right.
And you know, right now people think they're experts on everything because they look it up on Wikipedia. So you've got a real bad culture of people who are not only stupid, but they think they're smart.
Well, let me take it one step.
Combination.
Let me take it one step further, because you have, in terms of economic thinking, a shift that occurred in the 70s and the 80s that Lyndon LaRouche forecast in the late 60s, away from physical economy to total monetary valuation. And this has also is very much related to the internet, because Greenspan redefined productivity away from volume of production, physical goods, into dollars per hour. And, of course, this was related to this whole idea that all future discoveries will be in increasing the speed of digital transactions and reducing the size of the chip.
And you know, you've seen throughout the history of mankind that there's always these periods, which usually we call dark ages, are times when people said everything that can be discovered has been discovered,
mm-hmm.
and all those periods of history are always followed by revolutions in which future generations laugh at the stupidity of people who thought that. But that really is the arrogance of today. People say, you know, everything's been discovered with the development of quantum theory and the digital harnessing of the digital computer. There are no, you know, everything's finished. They said the same thing to Planck. Planck wanted to be a concert pianist, but he didn't think his skills were good enough for that. So he decided to take up physics, and when he went to his professor to ask for advice, his professor tried to discourage him, saying that with the discovery of the second law of thermodynamics, everything's been discovered in physics and there's nothing left to do.
Well, and this gets directly to the topic we started with, and I'd like to, we have about 15 minutes left in the program, just get back to that, because one of the things Lyndon LaRouche said in last night's Friday project, the fourth of his webcasts, is this question of the candidates talking down to the population. And the lower level of, you can't even call it cognition. It's, as one of you said earlier, it's like the people who paint their faces and go naked to football games to show their support for the home team. You have something similar with politics, and it reflects this dark age. So let's make this connection for people, because we are talking to the people who listen to this program who are capable of actually thinking these things through and feel liberated when they discover that they had a false belief, as opposed to threatened to the point of throwing down and fighting when someone challenges their opinion. So what is the connection then between the kind of creative thinking and scientific and technological progress versus the reduction to the level of popular opinion and pragmatism, and why that does lead to a dark age? Bill, why don't you start on that?
Well, I think one simple-minded way to look at it is take this deduction. There's two dominant parties. They run the country. You know, a lot of people think it's part of the Constitution, which it's not. And they're running Obama and Romney. Therefore, if you're for if you're against Obama, you're for Romney. And if you're against Romney, you're for Obama. And that's they are existing within an oligarchically fixed world, where the idea that there's something other than that, in this case something that's both historical and would represent the necessary future, because the issue then becomes what mission does the nation have to gather a presidency around? What creative acts can the United States take part in defending the earth along with the Russians? And so on. So if people believe that there is nothing, there is no purpose in life, there is no mission, life is fixed, there is no real change, there is no real development, they become stupid. They become stupefied, and therefore you can talk down to them because they're acting like stupid, ignorant people who don't want to bring any ideas into the situation or fight for anything, but just get what they can out of what is otherwise a dying system. This idea of a fixed system is a dead system. And the root of it, you know, monetarism bases itself on that. If you have a sense of the fact that the human species, and I think this was an important point that comes out of the landing in Curiosity, the idea that we now can explore minimally the solar system at an entirely different level of precision and expansion, then you have an idea that the human species is a self-evolving species, that the human ability to create, to discover new principles, in effect lifts us to a new species level, and that the unifying condition of that species development is what Lynn refers to as creativity per se. It's the creativity of the human species which sort of defines the human species as above species.
Well, on that, I'd like Bruce to comment on this question that's totally flows from what Phil just said, which is Lynn's discussion of the difference between a real sense of immortality and a mission purpose for a nation and for an individual driving for that kind of immortality, as opposed to someone who's looking out for a comfortable niche in heaven.
Well, you see this in the personalities of people like Planck and Einstein, who saw themselves as the inheritors of a great tradition of body of knowledge, which included not just scientific work, but also artistic work.
Classical music, yeah.
Classical music and so forth. And they saw themselves as the inheritors who were entrusted in their generation to take this great developments of human culture and improve it and add to it and give it to future generations in an upgraded form. And that also is exemplified by the way they live their lives as extremely there were people who had no trouble bucking popular opinion, and they did not bend at all to popular opinion and stood strong against popular opinion in all pressures. Today, people cave so quickly. As soon as they think something is unpopular, boom, they give up the idea, and then they seethe and get enraged at the fact that they capitulated. And again, I think it goes back to the general cultural degeneration that we've had, that over the last 60 years or 70 years or so, that goes into that. And that's really this question you raise around the issue of immortality, that it's been beaten out of our culture. I think also that gets to the question of, you see that in science. If you believe that the universe as a whole is actually tending towards death, heat death, the ultimate heat death of the universe, you get this perverse sort of Aristotelian idea that death, because it change ceases, is somehow a superior condition to life. And I think that's that right there is the sort of nub of what infects our scientific community and our artistic community.
Politically, that's the whole basis of the green movement, which essentially says there are too many people, and the best thing you could do is die young.
Yeah, and the green movement, the whole thing, and people don't see that, you know, you're given you're born and you have a creative capability, and that your mission in life has to be to develop that creative capacity for the future development of mankind and, by extension, the universe as a whole, with your brief span of life that will live long beyond you're gone. That there's a quality to you which is immortal, and man is the only species which has that capability. That's where this question of art comes in with science, because if you look at Planck and Einstein, I'm sure that they drew that sense of immortality from their deep love of classical art. They had a great connection to Beethoven, Mozart, Bach, and the great classical composers, and they understood this question of immortality not as a academic or dry intellectual argument, not a theological argument, but a characteristic by which they lived their lives. It was what they were.
Isn't that partly as well reflected in the attempt to define the mind as a left brain versus right brain? You're either artistic or you're scientific, driven by deduction and so on. I mean, that's always been part of the destruction of the society, is to try to define someone like Bach, for example, either as a pure mystic or else as a mathematical logician.
Right, to say that creative thought is an epiphenomena of some electrochemical, biochemical phenomena in the brain. Now, there may be, your brain is an organ, it's a biological organ, there are electrochemical, biochemical interactions in the brain, but those are an epiphenomena of thought, not the other way around. And what we don't do in our education and our development of people from childhood on, all through their life, because development doesn't end with your youthful education, should continue, is you have to develop that higher qualities of mind. And that's not a question that can be that an individual does alone. It really is the culture, and our culture celebrates stupidity. And if you have a culture that celebrates stupidity, you're swimming upstream if you want to do any thinking.
Well, it's also, Phil, the difference between what Mr. LaRouche always talks about by taking things from the top down rather than the bottom up.
Well, I think in one of the tough points here is that the immortality of the individual resides in the immortality of the species.
Right.
Not the mortal encasing. So you have to think of yourself as contributing to a species which would use your creative existence to further the existence of the species into the, relatively speaking, unforeseen future. You have to create a future that can create a future. And you have to think of yourself and the meaning of your life from that standpoint as embodied in future human beings, that they're really, in a sense, part of yourself, but yourself is understood from the standpoint of mind, so that there becomes a kind of universal mind, which is the history of the development of the human species, not only the past, but the potentials for the future, and you're in tune with that mind. I think this is one of the things that Planck went through, from viewing the mind as part of the ego to viewing the individual mind as part of a universal process of the development of humanity over not only the past, but into the future, and thinking from that standpoint. I think one of the big points of despair in the 20th century, you know, after World War One and other things of that nature, was this this almost embracing of pessimism. And you begin to realize that things like what seemed to be specialist economic questions or physics or whatever, these so-called experts, they have a certain importance. They're sort of the priesthood or the guardians, or as Bruce said, the priesthood of these religious beliefs. And once you accept that, your sense of purpose in the world, as we even see in the fundamentalists, their idea is they're going to get taken up somewhere and live a world of pleasure, and the hell with everybody else. And, well, you know, I think this is very much part of the cultural dumbing down of the population. Let me leave it at that.
Well, we're down to the last couple of minutes, so I just want to pull this together. First of all, I want to remind our listeners that there will be another one of these Friday Project webcasts this coming Friday. Lyndon LaRouche again, 8 p.m. Eastern on LaRouchePack.com. And also on Tuesday, Lyndon LaRouche and Jeffrey Steinberg, who's often a guest on this program, will be doing a press conference at the National Press Club on this question that we've been discussing of the unelectability of the two candidates, and yet the priority of getting Obama out to stop nuclear war. Bruce, just very quickly, if Obama's defeated, what are the prospects of avoiding nuclear war?
Well, I think the prospects of avoiding nuclear war are depend on us. You know, we've got some allies in the world who are willing to face this situation, who at least understand the danger of the war. The Russian military, the American military. But it really depends on whether or not we can pull together political forces, as far as I could see, under Lynn's leadership in the United States, as we started the discussion today with what he was saying. You got to get this three-point program. I mean, we've gotten to a point, as LaRouche has emphasized, where, you know, we've harnessed thermonuclear power, and that means that's the apex of war fighting. And once thermonuclear power becomes the apex of war fighting must cease to exist as a means of settling disputes among peoples and nations. And so the prospect of avoiding thermonuclear war is really the prospect of avoiding war altogether. Can mankind finally grow up and give up war as a means of settling arguments? And I think we can do that, but you got to have a statesman like LaRouche to do it.
Well, you have to have a population that takes up these great ideas. And let me just wrap this up by saying that if you've been able to follow this program for the full hour and you're inspired by these ideas, provoked by them, angry about them, that's good. That defines you as one of the small section of the population that's capable of thinking and therefore capable of leadership, provided you give up your indolent ways and actually continue that process of self-development, and not just for yourself, but as Phil and Bruce have both been discussing, for the universal benefit of the species of man. You can go to the LaRouche Pack website and pick up these recent papers by Lynn, the coming of the end of the cult of sense deception. The second Friday begins, and then the third one is the end for dummies. And the end for dummies is actually a good way to end this, because we'd like to end the rule of dummies on this planet. But as Bruce just said, that depends on you not being a dummy and making sure your friends are not dumbed down. So thanks for joining us today. Bruce and Phil, thank you very much for being guests on the program today.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be back, as always, next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern on The LaRouche Show.